In the last few years, no single work, no single book on the practice of ministry has been of greater help to me than one written by a member of the faculty at this institution. I'm referring to Father Henry Nouwen's little volume, The Wounded Healer. I was particularly struck by the old legend from the Talmud that furnishes the image that is the title of that book. I expect that most of you are familiar with it. It seems that a rabbi, Joshua ben Levi, came upon Elijah the prophet, and he asked him the ancient question, when will Messiah come? Elijah replied, go and ask him yourself. But where is he, was the reply, sitting at the gates of the city. But how shall I know him? He is sitting among the poor, covered with wounds. The others unbind all their wounds at the same time and then bind them up again. But he unbinds only one at a time and binds it up again, saying to himself, perhaps I will be needed. If so, I must always be ready, so as not to delay for a single moment. What came together for me as I first read that was that the secret of authentic ministry consists of two things. One, the faithful tending of our own woundedness, and two, the willingness to make available what we have found there to the woundedness of others. Now, it seems like to me this is a principle that is applicable to every facet of ministry, but particularly to the preaching event and to the aspect of it that I want to approach this afternoon. Yesterday, I used the two words, what and why, in trying to get at some of the dimensions of preaching. This afternoon, I want to raise the question, how? That is, the issue before us is that of appropriate methodology. How are we to do this awesome thing that we have been given, entrusted? How are we to find a vehicle that is appropriate to this endeavor? I realize at the very start that the enormity of the subject means that I cannot speak exhaustively. I cannot begin to cover all that would need to be said in trying to talk about the methodology of preaching. Therefore, I will content myself to make only one suggestion this afternoon, and that is that our preaching will be most effective when we are willing to take what we have gained in the grappling with our own woundedness and make this available to the woundedness of other people. Instead of trying to impress people with the breadth of my reading, instead of handing out information secondhand that may or may not have existential relevance to their particular need, if I am willing to lay bare my own struggles with the anguish of our human condition, if I am willing to take my own grappling and what has come out of that both in terms of light and darkness, if I am willing to make that available to other people, then I think that gives me a how for the doing of this awesome task. I heard Lloyd Ogilvie say one time that only the things that have happened to us can happen through us. And I believe that that is correct. What he is saying is that the thing that gives authenticity to preaching is that the preacher himself, herself, are vitally involved in the very realities that they proclaim. This is not just something that we're spinning off casually in some detached fashion. The things that we are daring to give in the pulpit are things that have first of all been given to us in the agony of our own struggle. Therefore, D.T. Niles has an analogy for this kind of preaching that I find very suggestive. He says the preacher is to be understood as one starving beggar pointing other starving beggars to where he, she have found the bread. In other words, if I have found something that is saving me, if I can identify resources that are becoming significant in my own unfolding, these are the things that I can share with authenticity. But how on earth can something be of much value as I give it if I myself have not appropriated it myself first? How can I make available to you what I have not exposed myself to and therefore let become a part of my own experience? Therefore, the truth that I have found, or more correctly, the truth that has found me, this is the powerful stuff that it seems like to me makes preaching what it ought to be, when I am daring to let what has happened to me also happen through me. Then I am beginning to deal with situations that make a difference to me, that make a difference to other people. It saves it from that kind of detached way of simply handing out theories, speculations, that even if correct, do not have existential moment. It is when I am grappling with something that is real to me, and I sense that it is real to you, that's what makes the powerful mix of preaching event. I had an older friend who was drafted into the Army at the beginning of World War II, and he was immediately assigned to an airborne division. Now, this was doubly dismaying to this country lad, because not only did he not want to be in the Army, he certainly didn't want to be up in an airplane about to have to jump out. In fact, he had never been up in a plane in his life. However, he was sent to a paratrooper school, was told that he had just this much time to be trained, and he reported to me later that nobody had to nudge him in the ribs and tell him to pay attention to the instructor. He was hanging on to every word that man was saying because he knew in a matter of days he was going to be up there several thousand feet in the air, and what he knew or did not know was going to be a matter of life and death. He also reported that the fact that the instructor was a seasoned paratrooper added validity to the things that the man was saying. Now, I like this as a sense of what preaching ought to be about. Here is somebody talking about something in which he or she have had some involvement existentially. They are speaking to a situation where the events are not just something that doesn't matter, but things that really do have significance. And if we can approach the preaching event in that kind of context, then it seems like to me that as we look at our own woundedness and are daring to make this open and available to others, as we are willing to struggle with the way that the truth and the way the agonies of life are happening to us, this gives us power in what we're trying to do for other people. I think that this is the high summons of preaching. Over there in the book that is now called 2 Isaiah, that unnamed prophet of the exile is called by God. In the King James Version, you find at the beginning of Isaiah 40, says those familiar words, comfort ye, my people, speak tenderly to Jerusalem. George Adam Smith has said that that second phrase could more aptly be translated, speak home to the hearts of Jerusalem. This is what existential preaching is all about. It is getting beneath the surface. It is going to the very core of another's being with ultimate concern. And my contention this afternoon at the point of methodology is that the truth that has the best chance of speaking home to the heart of another person is the truth that has first come home to the heart of the preacher. That which I would give, first of all, I have to receive. That which I would pass on to another, I must first of all have become intimately involved with in my own experience. I suppose then this is why the great German preacher theologian Helmut Thielicke has concluded that the two most powerful forms of preaching are what he calls declaration and confession. This I declare unto you, speaking out of the light that has been given in my own struggle, this I confess unto you. Here is where the darkness is still upon me. Here is where the ambiguities have not been resolved. Here is where I am yet struggling alongside you. Therefore, the preaching that is willing to take both its light and its darkness and make that available, my wounds for your woundedness, my struggles alongside your struggles, I want to suggest this afternoon that that methodology, that approach to preaching, I think has the best promise of speaking home to the heart. That means then that I better not traffic in affirmations that may be objectively true and yet they have not become true for me. It means that I better not stand in the pulpit and simply talk about things that it would be nice to know about, things that are really true perhaps in some far-off sense, but have not come home to me in ways that are saving and making a difference. Now, I wish that I had been taught this as a much younger Christian, because you need to realize that I grew up as a Southern Baptist in a denomination that is super, hyper evangelical, and almost in the moment that we're converted, we are called on to go and begin to become soul winners. We are thrust many times ahead of ourselves. We are pushed into saying things to other people about spiritual realities before they have really become ours in a first-hand way. And to deal in second-hand affirmations, even if they're true, is not, it seems like to me, the most effective way to go about this task. In fact, I can remember a great deal of embarrassment and pain as I did not, first of all, grapple with my own woundedness, but rather rushed out to try to do something for the woundedness of others, and I was not effective. I suppose I started my pilgrimage the same way each one of you did, namely taking over secondhand the faith of my family and of my culture. I happened to be born in a home of great devoutness, and therefore it was easy for me to hear religious affirmations and to make them my own as a child does. I took them in uncritically as I took in my mother's milk. However, I found relatively early in life that secondhand affirmations will not stand the test in this kind of world. In fact, my innocence, religiously speaking, came to an end at the ripe old age of 10. It all started when a new family moved in up the street from us in Nashville, Tennessee. The father had just retired from a career in the military. They had a son about my age, and I was astonished, provincial now, little southern boy, to find that I now had a neighbor up the street who had lived in three places overseas, the Panama Canal Zone, Germany, and the Philippine Islands. He was talking firsthand about places that I had hardly even read about. Therefore, I held him in a kind of awe. Here was the most cosmopolitan peer that I had ever run into in my young life. One Sunday afternoon, we were out in the backyard playing, and my mother called me to come in. My friend was upset because our play was interrupted, and he said, "Why do you have to leave?" And I said, quite innocently, "I have to go in and get dressed to go to church." You need to realize that Southern Baptists are three-timers each week, Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Wednesday night. I have a lady that said, "I'd love to be a Baptist, but I just don't have the strength." And I can understand her dilemma. Well, my friend, on hearing why it was that I was having to leave, got a dark scowl on his face, and he said, "Church, do you believe in that sort of thing? My father says that anybody who thinks there is a God is just a plain fool." Well, I was absolutely flabbergasted. Realized now that I had been raised in the protectiveness of a very, very conservative home. I had never heard anybody say anything approaching that. And here, suddenly, in my own backyard, a live atheist standing before me. And I did exactly what I think we always do when we're frightened, when we're up against the unprecedented. The best defense is a good offense. I got red in the face and swelled up, and I said back to him, "Well, my father thinks there's a God. I think your father's the one that's a fool." And with that word of loving witness, I turned to walk in-house to go to do what we Baptists do on Sunday night, namely learn how to witness to the pagans. However, something had happened in the backyard that I could not dismiss from my consciousness. Now, you may find this a little surprising. 10 years old, certainly untrained in the philosophic arts, but I could not go to sleep that night because I was trying to sort out in my own childish way the implications of what had occurred. I remember saying to myself, "Here I am believing there is a God because my father says there is one, and here is my friend doing the same thing, only coming to the absolute opposite conclusion." And I found myself confronted that night with a question I could not answer, namely, how do you know that your father's right and his father's wrong? That was the end of innocence for me as far as religious certainty was concerned. I realized that night that the world is big and diverse, that there are lots of opinions. I came out of the unbroken innocence of childhood where everything is taken for granted, and the dilemma, the anxiety of alternatives became real. That night, 10 years of age, I became a person of questions, acquainted with doubt. I began to realize that there had to be something more solid than somebody else's opinion to hold the altar of religious certainty. But I didn't know where to look, because I wasn't in a church that taught us to ask and to seek and to knock. I was not in a church that understood the relationship between doubt and faith. And therefore, I didn't know where to go, what to do. And about a few weeks later, lo and behold, at the church that I was attending, they schedule what is called in Baptist parlance a youth revival. We had a college student much more filled with vitality than with wisdom, to come and to preach for a week to our congregation. You need to realize that my home regular pastor was utterly faithful, utterly steadfast, but there was not a semblance of color about anything that he did. And here, suddenly blowing into the pulpit, is this brash young man dressed in colorful clothes, carrying a trombone of all things with him, which he would periodically reach down and give a few hot licks on in the midst of his sermon, moved all around in the pulpit. It was something the likes of which I had never seen before, an absolute marvel to behold. And though I had already begun to develop the habits of inattentiveness in church because of its utter predictability, when that man came, I really did prick up my ears and begin to listen. And on the third night, would you believe it, he talked about doubt and what he had done to resolve the problem of not being certain about religious reality. I'll never forget it as long as I live. He told us that one night he took the Bible in his college dorm room, opened it up, and got down on his knees before it, a posture that he then enacted right there in the pulpit. And he said, "I said to the Holy Bible, I do not understand all your teachings. I cannot answer all the criticisms that are leveled against you. But I hereby choose to believe that you are the Word of God. You contain the truth, and I will accept you unequivocally. I will speak where you speak. I will be silent where you're silent. I hereby accept you as the Word of God." And he claimed he got up off his knees and had never had another doubt. Well, there I sat, 10 years of age, having just freshly come out of innocence, and I said to myself, of course. Here's how I can know how my father's right and his father's wrong. Here is a document that everybody accepts, a document of antiquity. Here is the authority that I have been looking for. Here I can be certain because it's written right here in black and white on the page. And that night I moved from the state of realizing that secondhand faith is not enough to basing my certainty on a religious document that was very tangible, that everybody that I knew accepted and revered. And that was the beginning of a real time of growth in my own spiritual life. For the first time, I started reading the Bible intelligently. In fact, much of what I know about Holy Scripture, I'm sure, is in my foundation now because of the period of years that I spent regarding this as the Word of God, the source of certainty. In fact, that served me quite well until years later I was to have another fateful encounter. I was a senior in high school by this time, and there came to our particular high school in Nashville a young Iranian student under the auspices of the American Friends Service. Right after school started, the family that he was to have lived with got transferred. The only way it could be worked out for him to stay was to move to a family that did not have a student in our high school, which kind of left this lad dangling unattended. And I was president of the student body that year. The principal asked if I would take Ahmad under my wing and kind of shepherd him and get him started in the new place. And that was the beginning of a very significant friendship. I went over to his house one night, had dinner with the people in whose home he was staying, and then we went upstairs to his room, and for the first time, we got to the subject of religion. I remember saying to him very innocently, "Ahmad, do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God who has died for your sins?" And he was a very courteous person, and he said, "No, why should I?" You're not going to believe this, but I reached in my pocket for my soul winner's New Testament that had all the plan of salvation underlined so you could get to it quickly. And I had every confidence of taking John 3:16, pasting it right on his forehead, and then he too would know and be certain about what I knew and was certain of. And I remember as I was preparing to read from my blessed holy document that he raised his hand and said, "Wait a minute. You need to know that I don't accept something as true just because it's in the Holy Bible. As far as I'm concerned, that is a book of myth and superstition. I do not accept it." I cannot tell you how flabbergasted I was. Now realize, this is Nashville, Tennessee. This is the center of Southern evangelical Christianity, where most of the Bibles are actually printed. Now I had known people in my life who didn't take the Bible seriously, but I had never encountered anybody that didn't believe it was true or accept its authority, and I was struck absolutely dumb standing there with my New Testament in my hand. And I remember in that awkward moment that Ahmad turned the tables on me. He said, "Do you believe that Allah is the only true God and Muhammad is his prophet?" And I said, "No, why should I?" And so help me, he turned around and pulled from his bookshelf a book that looked all for all the world like a Holy Bible. It was about the same size, Morocco bound, black, except across the front were written the words, "The Quran." I'd never even heard of such a document. And he said, "Because this holy book says that it's so." And there we were, two men clutching our holy books as the basis of our authority. And the question that had first come to me at the ripe old age of 10 came again, only this time the form was, "How do you know that your book is right and his book is wrong?" Well, that was the beginning of a long and difficult time of not knowing in my adolescent existence. In fact, I remember things were so awkward, I excused myself as quickly as I could. And as I was walking home through the cool fall evening, I looked up and the moon and the stars were so bright in the sky. And I remember stopping, I could take you to the very street corner at this moment. I remember stopping and looking up at the heavens and saying, "Boy, this religion business is a whole lot more complicated than I realized. Who are you, God? Are you Jehovah? Are you Allah? Will the true God please stand up?" And then I remember I began to bargain. I said, "If you will just give me a clue as to who you are, if you will just give me some inkling to your uniqueness, if I can just know which out of both of these alternatives is right, I will do my best to accept, I will do my best to build my life around you." And then I began to plead, "Mystery, mystery, what is your name?" Now, if intensity of desire would justify a response, I should have gotten it that night, because no adolescent was ever more earnest in wanting to know the truth about God. But as I poured out my plea into the heavens that night, they became as silent as a tomb. There was no answer that night, or the next night, or the next night, or the next week, or the next month, or the next year. You see, I know what they're talking about when they speak of the silence of God, the absence of God, yes, even the death of God. I know what it's like to want to know and yet have no evidence outside yourself on which to ground a conviction. I know what it's like to feel that you're falling through space and everything you touch moves, nothing stays put. I know what it's like to have this great sense of emptiness all about you, but not having any way to feel ground under your feet that will hold you and give you assurance. And that went on for a long, long time. And I remember several things about that particular stage of my own adolescence. I decided after a few weeks that evidently this was not going to resolve itself very quickly. And so I settled down to simply admitting to myself that other people were certain, but I had no way within myself of knowing that what they were believing was true. I also remember gingerly trying to find some help for this problem. And I get very, very sad as I think about the kind of church in which I was raised that had so much warmth and so much dynamism, but nobody there understood how to birth a doubter on into faith. I had sense enough not to raise this issue with my parents because I knew they were so bound up with my life that they couldn't handle it. But I did one day ask my Sunday school teacher, "How do you know that the Bible is true and the Quran is false?" He obviously couldn't handle that kind of question because he did the same thing to me that I had done to my 10-year-old friend in the backyard. He got red in the face and he said, "The idea, you asking a question like that with the kind of mother you've got." He condemned me. He made me feel that there was something wrong for even asking the question, and I didn't need condemnation. I didn't need exhortation. I needed evidence and understanding. But it wasn't to be had in my home church, and so to use a term that is now quite popular, I went into the closet as far as my own uncertainty was concerned. But the other thing I remember, and for this I will be everlastingly grateful to God, for some reason I did not give way to cynicism and despair. I did not conclude that because I did not know, I could not know. I think you have to say that despair is really presumptuous. Despair is saying something about the future we have no right to say because we haven't been there yet. It's almost saying that there is nothing else possible beyond what is, and who are we to conclude that about a God who can make the things that are out of the things that are not, a God who can call dead things to come to life again. For some reason, I did not give way to despair. I remember thinking that though I did not know, perhaps if I would open the windows of my life 360 degrees around, perhaps if I would go back to square one and begin to start the religious search as if I had never done anything at all, then maybe someday, somehow, I would find some certainty that would give me ground to stand on, and once again, I could believe. And it was in this stance that I graduated from college and graduated from high school and went on to college, and there, goodness and mercy followed me. Because it so happened that the little junior college that I went to in Morris Hill, North Carolina, a man who had just graduated from this institution, Carl Harris, he teaches now at Wake Forest, he was beginning as a Bible teacher in this little junior college. He was a bachelor. He lived downstairs in the dorm where I was assigned. I took his required course in freshman religion. I hadn't been in a week before I realized that here deep was calling unto deep. I quickly sensed that here was a man who understood the creative relationship between doubt and faith, and it wasn't long before I made my way down to his room, told him of the things that I had experienced, and he didn't fall in a faint, he didn't get red in the face, but he rather said, you need to look at this, you need to look at that. He heard me out, he answered me with evidence, he got me in touch with stuff like Augustine's Confessions, Pascal's Pensées, he got me in touch with some of the writings of William Temple. He was an absolute minister of grace and truth at a very, very important time. And I remember beginning to get hope from him that if I would continue to ask and seek and knock, something eventually would come of it. The next Christmas, my sophomore year, somebody, I don't even remember who, gave me as a gift J.B. Phillips' new little book entitled Your God is Too Small. For reasons that I don't know, I didn't read it at the time. It lay on my shelf. But one languid spring afternoon, without anything else much to do, I happened to look at it. I picked it up. I was intrigued by it as it talks about the false images we have of God in our childhood. And then he makes a case for incarnational Christianity. He kept referring to the Gospel of John. And I remember laying aside Phillips' book, picking up the Bible, opening to the fourth Gospel, and beginning to read that magnificent prologue. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And at that point, I have a little trouble putting into words exactly what happened. As if I had been utterly alone, and then I realized that I was being companioned by another. As if I'd been in a place of great darkness, and slowly a light had begun to shine and move toward me, as if I'd been in a place where there was utter silence, and then there began the sound of many waters. There began to reverberate all about me the affirmation, this is true. To the mystery of Godness, this one gives a face. He became what we are, flesh and blood, so we could understand what he is. I was absolutely startled to find this affirmation breaking in upon me from outside, because the truth was I had not expected that conclusion. In fact, I had even gotten to the place that I did not even want that conclusion to be true. There had been a time when I think I was utterly open, but across the intervening times, I had developed a kind of prejudice against the church that had not been patient with my doubt, against a family that many times was trying to put things on me. And to be perfectly honest with you, it would not have bothered me at all at that stage in my development to have gone home and said very loudly, I am now a Buddhist, I have now rejected the Christian faith, just to watch the shock that would have come over all those people who had watched me grow up. The point I'm making is this was not something that I expected to learn. This was not something I wanted to learn. This was something that broke in from beyond with that solid otherness of reality. And I found myself that afternoon much like C.S. Lewis says he was at the time of his conversion. He says that contrary to what those who think that religion is nothing but the projection of our wishes on the screen of reality, his experience was exactly the opposite. Lewis said, instead of saying, oh, I hope Christianity is true, but I'm afraid it's not, he was saying, I'm afraid it's true, but I hope it's not. And in all honesty, that was my mental mood. I really wasn't expecting or wanting that conclusion, but I had asked some 2 years before, mystery, mystery, what is your name? And here suddenly breaking in from beyond me in ways I could not deny was an answer to the question that I had asked for, I had sought for, I had knocked for. And I had enough sense of presence as it was happening to realize this is the thing that I have wanted. This is the ground of certainty that I have prayed for. And therefore, in that moment, as that affirmation was breaking in from beyond, when the door was open, I walked through it. When the hand was extended, I reached out and took hold of it. All I know to say to you this afternoon is that in that moment, the mystery of godness happened in my experience. That phrase is not original with me. Gertrude Bahner, great lay woman, says that in her own life, after years of searching, after a long bout with alcoholism, one attempt at suicide, two wrecked marriages, she too found herself encountered by the numinous, bathed by that incredible, mysterious light. And after 20 minutes of it and it had worn off, this one who had very little background in religion picked up the telephone, called her secretary and said, please bring me a copy of the Holy Bible as quickly as you can. And the secretary was so startled that she could not contain herself and she blurted out, my God, what's happened to you? And Gert answered softly, my God has happened to me. It's a metaphor, a way of saying what can really not be said, describing what in fact cannot be described. All I can say to you is that from beyond, something broke within. And because I had so long wanted to have certainty, not of my own projection, but of its own density, when it happened, when he happened, I said yes, and the heart found its reasons that reason knows not of. I learned that afternoon that faith is not believing the unbelievable. It's not committing intellectual suicide. It's not taking a leap in the dark. But faith is the response of the human spirit to the inthrust of God. Faith is saying yes to that which first speaks to us. Faith is an avenue to knowledge. It is not an alternative to knowledge. Now, reality, as I understand it, exists about us in all different kinds of forms. And we humans have a variety of capacities by which we can perceive. For example, there is the dimension of color. Corresponding to that is the capacity of sight. There is the dimension of sound. Corresponding to that, the capacity of hearing. There's the dimension of odor, corresponding to that, the capacity of smell. Here is reality in all these forms. Here we are with these variety of ways to perceive them. And when you get the perceiving mechanism in turn, in tune with that which it is supposed to perceive, this is when knowledge begins to happen. You do not talk about smelling the color red. This would be using one faculty to try to get in touch with another kind of reality. All right, what I learned that afternoon is that faith is a sixth sense. It is yet another capacity that we humans have been gifted with. Faith is our way of getting in touch with the ultimate dimension of existence, what the eye is to color, what the ear is to sound, what the nose is to odor. Faith is to the mystery of godness. And he came in ways that encompassed all of my senses. He came as a piece of datum that I had to work with. He happened that day. And because I had that experience, now I have something to share with others in terms of the mystery of godness. Now it is possible for me to take the stance that the Bible commends to all of us in this area, namely the stance of witness. Now I can say this is the way it happened to me, and can take this experience and share it with others in the hope that what has happened to me because of my sharing it can now begin to happen through me as mysterious spirit takes the truth of one's experience and makes it truth to another. Now, I grew up in a denomination that taught more about soul winning than it did about witnessing. And the image here is one of conquest. The witness here is one of convincing. And I think that that is a very erroneous way of doing religious truth. Jesus did not call us to go out and conquer the weakness of others. He simply invites us to be his witnesses. That is, go and tell people what has happened to you. Make available to them the light that has begun to break into your own experience. I bid you to be an honest witness, the same way if you went into a law court and took the oath. Your only obligation in the courtroom would be to tell your participation in the event as honestly as you could. You don't have to get in the jury box. Get the people by the neck and make them believe what you say. All you do is to tell your involvement in faithful and honest ways. And what I'm suggesting is that as we grapple with this whole area of what is true, mystery, mystery, what is your name, as we ourselves do our asking, our seeking, and our knocking, the truth that has come home to our hearts, that has been commended through our experience, that becomes the datum that we have to share with others. And the things that I have never experienced, the things that have not ever become existentially truth for me, I don't have to argue about them. I don't have to reject them. They simply are not going to be part of the potency, it seems to me, that is given to one when, within the circle of the light that has come upon you, you dare to say, this is what has happened to me, and I make it available to you. You need to know about this as you're making up your own mind. It is my contention that this is the only kind of truth we have a right to give, the truth, namely, which we have received. I also happen to think that this form of truth has the best chance of making it home to the heart of another in the kind of cultural atmosphere in which we're living today. Claxton Monroe, Episcopal priest down in Houston, has pointed out that we have a great, great confusion of religious authority today. There was a time that when the hierarchy of the church said something, everybody accepted it, but that broke up in the Renaissance and the Reformation. At that point, it was the authority of the written document that took the place of the authority of the church, but now, after centuries of biblical criticism, even that has been eroded in the minds of many, many unbelievers. There was a day, perhaps, that citing a scripture would end an argument. Today, in all likelihood, it would simply start one. It is not the way that a whole group of unbelievers are willing to take religious authority. What then, Monroe says, is likely to penetrate the scientific skepticism of our day? He says, an honest word of testimony, saying to a person, the same way that you would say, I saw a wreck out on the street, here is what has happened to me in the realm of the spirit. Whereas this is by no means guaranteed to get through, we are, at least in our secular culture, still committed to shaping our conclusions on the basis of evidence. If you are a true scientist and you go into the lab and you encounter a fact, you do not change the fact to suit your theory. You are under obligation to change your theory in light of the fact that you have encountered. Therefore, he says that when honest people who have no axes to grind, no profit to make, say to other people, this has happened to me, and you have a right to know about it as you're making up your own mind, he thinks that this kind of word has the best chance of penetrating the grids of our secular society. He goes on to say he thinks the layperson has the best potency here, that many people in our society are very, very prejudiced against the clergy. They think we're paid to affirm as we do. But a layperson, he thinks, is able to penetrate many times that skepticism. I see his point, but I think that it's still true that when the preacher dares to say, this is the light that has happened to me, and here is how it's happened. And I think you need to take this into account as you're making your own theories, coming to your own conclusions about reality. What I'm saying is that if we will let the light that is happening to us become the basis of our declaration, then it has the best likelihood of moving through us and speaking home to the hearts of those who do not yet believe. But remember, Tillich has said that we not only have the declarative form of preaching, there is also that other powerful form, the form he calls confession. I take that to mean that not just the light that has been given to me, but also the darkness in which I still find myself, that too has potency for preaching. That if we will learn how to make the struggles that are still ours visible and available to other people, that this too may be a way of speaking home to the heart. In fact, I will go so far to say, as I have thought about this process, I've come to the conclusion that the sharing of my confession, that is, the making available the darkness that I'm still struggling with, may be the clue to what I find one of the most difficult aspects of ministry, and that is the facilitating of creative change, the doing the work of a prophet, the coming to a person or a situation who has a serious problem, and instead of antagonizing the problem and making it more entrenched than ever, of somehow setting in motion the forces that can bring healing and openness where once there is sickness. Could it be that the preached word of confession is the most potent way that true prophetic ministry can be accomplished? One of the things that I grieved the most about over my seminary training was that I got out without understanding what a highly complex and ambiguous thing this whole matter of change agency really is. I somehow had the idea that you were to go out like Amos went to Bethel, that all it took was reality perception and a whole lot of courage, cram it up their nose, and that was the way that you did the work of the prophet. And then one day I realized that Bethel only became more rigidified because of that kind of strategy. And my earliest efforts at trying to bring about change through that kind of condemnation had the same counterproductive effects. What I did not know is that change by its very nature is deeply ambiguous. Why should we be surprised? If something qualifies for the word change, then it means that you get something that you didn't have and you give up something that you did have. Isn't that bottom line definition of a change? You get something that you didn't have. There is a gain dimension. You give up something that you did have. There is a loss dimension. That means that if change is this by nature, we are going to have ambiguous responses as the prospect of change is proposed. Now, part of me, when you say change, is going to leap up positively and say, I want to change, I want to grow. I've never known anybody that was completely satisfied with the way they are. We all want to grow, develop, become better. We have a hunger for adventure, Paul Tournier says, as deep as our hunger for food. There is in me that which is very excited when the prospect of change is proposed, because change always brings me something I didn't have, and there's always something more that I want. By the same token, the same proposal also activates all kinds of negative energies in me, because change involves risk. It means going into a place where I've never been before. Things may not be very good as they are, but at least I know them. I have no idea what the new situation is going to be like. It also involves a great deal of fear. It also, if it's called for by somebody else, injects the note of shame. If I say to you, you have got to change, I am implying that there is something wrong with you, that I am better and that you are worse, and that sets up all kinds of resistant, rebellious forces. Therefore, part of me rises up toward change. Other parts of me are deeply resistant. And the great strategy here is, how can we mobilize the forces within that want to change and use them to overcome the forces in us that are resistant to change. But what I was late learning is that in this highly ambiguous situation, condemnation is almost always counterproductive. If I come in and tell you, you have got to change, or you're bad, you're sick, I'm not going to like you unless you change, or some kind of terrible thing is going to happen to you, the tendency is that that frightens me, that activates all of the energies that I have that are afraid. What it sounds like is that I am being attacked by somebody that does not like me, and we human beings are instinctively defensive when we feel we're under threat. If you came up here right now and threw something at my face, I wouldn't stop to analyze what it was. My hands would go up, my eyes would flash closed. We are instinctively defensive when we think we're under threat. And whenever change is called for out of condemnation, I don't care how correct the reality perception is, the spirit behind it is so frightening that what happens is the person rigidifies, throws up their hands, digs in their feet, and then as a rule, they counterattack. And they said, who gave you the right to be a judge over me? You're not so good yourself. And so they begin to give it back to you. Jesus described the process perfectly. He says over there in the Sermon on the Mount, judge not that you be not judged. I think that ought to be translated, condemn not that you be not condemned. Jesus is not talking here about discernment. He's talking here about the contempt that says to another, I don't like the way you are. He says when that kind of condemnation goes out, it almost always scares the object to death, rigidifies the person. They counterattack. The measure that you give is the measure that you get back. And what happens is that the issue that caused the whole exchange at the beginning is lost. It becomes a war between the two forces, and no real creative change has come as a result of condemnation. Oh, how I wish I had known that as an early young minister, because I went out from the seminary filled with the sense that I must be courageous and I must be prophetic. And I think about the second sermon that I preached at a little town that I went to in Tennessee. I told those people, in effect, you're not a church. You are the Republican Party at prayer. You are a religious country club. But I have hope for you. I have come. I have the right answers. I have the vision of what the body of Christ ought to be. I have come to make you into something you are not. And then I wondered that they began to oppose me on every front. Everything I suggested that we do, there was all this kind of infighting, all this kind of wariness. Why? Because I had not first come across as somebody who cared for them. I had come at them as somebody who did not like them. We never confess to our critics. If I'm going to be operated on, be put under an anesthetic, and therefore my body become utterly and totally vulnerable, I want to know two things about the surgeon. Is he competent? Is she competent? And secondly, does that surgeon hold my personhood in high regard? If they're going to use me for one of their experiments, if they just want to cut on my insides to see what's there for some reason that they have, I'm not about to open up my sensitive inwardness to somebody that I perceive does not esteem me. And what I'm saying is that condemnation has behind it this sense that I don't like what you are, and we do not turn ourselves over to those kinds of spirits to change us. We do not confess to our critics. We rigidify. No wonder Bethel absolutely bowed its back and rejected Amos, because all they heard was attack, and we humans defend ourselves in that situation. I wish I had known that. Because the truth is, in the same passage where Jesus says, condemn not that you be not condemned, but with the condemnation that you give, a condemnation almost always comes back. On down there, he proposes another alternative for change agency. It grows out of that ludicrous Oriental hyperbole, the person with a splinter sticking way out of their eye, proposing to take out a speck of sawdust in somebody else's eye. Nobody, Jesus says, in his right mind submits to that kind of operation. But what if the person with the splinter in his, her eye, What if they begin to work on the problem at the points that it touches his, her life? What if instead of condemnation, what if change were called for out of a stance of solidarity? What if we begin to say I instead of you? What if the whole context for working with a dark spot is given the word we? Here you have the preacher saying, I'm having trouble with the war in Vietnam. I find it so ambiguous and so difficult to know what I think. I'm having trouble with the race problem. I was raised in prejudice, and I am by no means completely clear of it. I'm having trouble understanding how it's right for me to have so much property when so many people have so little. What I'm suggesting is that if we are willing to make visible our struggles with the darkness, the places where we have not yet got it resolved, the places where we sense we need to come and stand under Christ and receive from him the same thing that another brother and sister needs as they struggle with their darkness, it is amazing. We don't confess to our critics, but we do sometime to a fellow struggler. If I am honest enough to say, here is where I'm hurting, and here is where I'm needing help, what that does is to take the element of loneliness, the element of shame, out of the whole transaction. Somebody sees me doing this and says, well, if he's willing to admit he has the problem, maybe I can find the courage to admit that I'm having it. If he is willing to work with it, maybe there's hope as I work with it. Suddenly, a community emerges in the darkness, and people begin to come out of the closets and out of the woodwork because somebody has dared to say I and we instead of the condemning you. We don't confess to our critics, but the people that have courage enough to come alongside us and say, I sense that what you need is what I need. I sense that what we both must do is to go and stand under Christ and ask his forgiveness and his power on each of our dark places. Companionship comes to the lonely. Shame is lifted. Hope is injected. And the confessional word becomes what St. Paul, I think, found it to be. When I am weak, then, lo and behold, I come into a new kind of strength. I must admit to you that I stumbled into the confessional mode of preaching without fully realizing what was happening. Back in the summer of 1969, our 8.5-year-old daughter was diagnosed as having leukemia. It was a terrific blow. Church family that I was working with in Kentucky was very, very supportive and sympathetic. I was not able to preach the Sunday after we got that word because the impact was so enormous. But the next Sunday, when I got ready to go in my pulpit, I decided that because all of these people knew that this thing was happening to me and to our family, that what I ought to do would be to go and to share with them where we were, what we faced, my agonies, my dilemmas, what truth I was finding to be in this situation. And so that Sunday, I simply came as a broken brother into the circle of the family, and I told them what had happened to me out there in the darkness, my questions, my doubts, my anxieties. I simply laid it out, not as some solved problem, but the way it was. She went into a remission. 9 months later, we had had all kinds of hopes that perhaps she was better. She had a terrible relapse. And once again, I couldn't preach because it was such an enormous thing, but when it was time to go back, again something had happened. Again, I went and shared with the brothers and sisters, not any solution, but just simply the agony of working with a dying child. And then on a Saturday afternoon, as the snow was falling softly outside her window, on January the 10th of 1970, we lost the battle. And she slipped away into the mystery. It was 6 weeks before I had the strength and the courage to go back to the place of preaching. But when I went once again, simply as a witness to tell them of the darkness. I told them of my questions, the questions that thronged as to why is there leukemia? Why did she have to suffer so incredibly? What is the meaning of this event? I made no attempt to hide anything. I told it as I had experienced it. It wasn't all darkness. I found down in the bottom of that black, black valley of the shadow of death, I found an incredible gift. I found the vision that life itself is gift. I found it, strangely enough, with Abraham up on the top of Mount Moriah. Von Rod says that the real meaning of that awesome thing that Yahweh asked of Abraham, to take little Isaac with all he represented and go up there on the mountain and offer him as a sacrifice, that what was really happening was Yahweh was trying to find out, did Abraham remember where Isaac came from and who he was? It is so easy to become possessive of children are things that matter, to forget that we have never earned them or deserved them, that they are to be held lightly and gratefully. They are not ours. And Von Rod says that there on the mountain, when it came clear that Abraham remembered that Isaac was gift, that he had always belonged to God and always would, that was the crucial test that Abraham passed. And it suddenly came home to me, Laura Lou was always a gift, had never really been mine. And what I learned out of that experience was that if I simply asked, why did she die, all I got was bitterness and anger. But if I could ask, why was she ever born? And sense the grace that is utterly beyond our deserving that gives us everything, then viewing her as gift, I could look back on the 10 years and be incredibly grateful, and I could use the occasion of her being taken to give thanks that she'd ever been given at all. It wasn't all darkness. There was the light of grace that had first been given to me in that experience. And after that sermon, some people said, my, to hear a preacher stand up and say that he is angry with God and ask questions. I've never heard such a thing. There were some folk who were offended by the honesty, but many, many more found identification with a fellow struggler. And that was almost 9 years ago, and I cannot tell you from that time until now how many grieving people have pulled up alongside me and said, I know that you understand what it's like, and your daring to say the darkness has drawn me to you. We need to struggle together. I'm not saying confessional preaching is the total answer for every prophetic need. I'm saying to you that there are many, many dangers confessional preaching can draw attention to yourself in exhibitionist ways. Confessional preaching could lead you into all kinds of phoniness, making up a problem just to identify, and that's not what I mean. All I'm saying to you is that of all the methodologies that I know of getting to sick people in ways that will help them mobilize their desire to change against the powers that resist change, there's hardly anything as potent as somebody acknowledging their kinship and comradeship, who is willing to say I and we instead of you, and offer themselves, if nothing else, as a companion in the darkness. The question then is how shall we preach? I'm suggesting this afternoon that if we will take what comes from the faithful tending of our own woundedness and make this available to the woundedness of others, if we will let what is happening to us also happen through us, if we dare to take the light that has been given and the darkness that we're still experiencing, who knows? He may once again happen through preaching. So let it be. So let it be. Amen.